Okay, good afternoon. Today we have a current guest. David Gunkel was here before you as a guest. And now we have Kathleen Gabriels. Kathleen Gabriels has a background in moral philosophy and moral sciences, and does media ethics and computer ethics. I thought it's interesting when it comes to critical approaches and also feminist theory to ask her to contribute to the lectures, because that gives you again these different perspectives. Good to see you back, Bethel. What I will do is I will first introduce the topic and put it in the context of the course, also a little bit put a critical theory in context, and then Kathleen will take over with first critical theory and philosophy of technology, and then more the feminist approaches. So this is the context of the course again. So we have all these different approaches, and so next time, by the way, I'm going to add except analytic approaches in general, also philosophy of information. So we'll say more about that. But today we have the critical theory and feminist theory. So the structure is a little bit that first critical theory, where does it come from, and then the people to focus on is Marcuse and Finberg. Finberg has been influenced by Marcuse, so that this is a nice lineup, so to speak. Then we have feminist theory, where again the question concerning technology is asked, but this time from a different perspective, a feminist perspective. It's not that feminist theory is totally disconnected, of course, from critical theory, from phenomenology, and so on. It has all these connections. But I thought it's worth to include this also really in our course as a separate perspective on its own. I'm not going to talk too long to leave enough time for the lecture, because there's a lot of content there. Let me first say that critical theory is of course rooted in the work of Karl Marx, and without giving a total analysis of the works of Marx, it's for this purpose here in the lectures, it's good to introduce the idea that critical theory looks at modes of production, and from modes of production then goes to arguments about capitalism. And what Marx thought was problematic about mode of production in the industrial society he saw is the private ownership of the production means. And the problematic thing is that it creates a particular kind of relation then to those who do not own these means of production. In particular, if you compared to the situation of in a workshop, for example, in crafts, or as a farmer, when you have direct relation to the products you're making and to the process, because you're basically you're doing it yourself, you're using simple tools. Once you have a machine, and that machine being owned by someone else, you're just going to do a little bit of the whole process, and so you get alienated from the process and from the product you create. You don't have a feeling anymore that it's your own product. And indeed, also literally, it is not your own product, because you're paid, it's wage labor, you're paid for the work you do, Marx then criticized that the capitalist basically uses the surplus value from this labor for making profit for himself. So that's problematic, and the estrangement is problematic. Also, he said that it's not only the people that have a problem, it's also that then all kind of commodities, that they're estranged from us if we don't make them ourselves, if they're made in this kind of mode of production and modes of ownership. Because then he says that in this kind of capitalist system, then everything else, all kinds of goods and services also are turned into commodities. So all kind of things that we normally consider to be values apart from the economy, he says that's a danger that they're all going to be commodified. And I now give the word to Kathleen, who will talk more about this, because Marcuse was, of course, very known for also saying about this processes of commodification, objectification, but then in relation to technology. Okay. Give you the word.
Once again, welcome everyone. So, where will I focus on in the rest of this lecture? First of all, I will dig a bit deeper into the notion of, or the school of critical theory. Afterwards, I will focus on the American philosopher Andrew Feinberg, who came up with, he works on critical theory of technology. So he basically extrapolates critical theory to the field of technology. And after that, we'll talk a bit further on feminist theory, a feminist looks upon technology. And if there is still time left, I hope there will be some, we will have some time for a discussion. So, I guess you've heard about critical theory before, or who has never heard of the critical theory? Okay, everyone. There's a broad meaning, but there's also a narrow meaning. We will focus on the narrow meaning, which basically means that it deals with critical theory coming from the Frankfurter Schule, and they operate in a Marxist tradition, hence the introduction on Marx. Where does the notion of kritische Theorie come from? It's from a text written by Mark Horkheimer in 1937. He's one of the most well-known scholars of the Frankfurter Schule. He wrote Traditionelle und kritische Theorie, and afterwards the whole school was named after this text. I guess you're all familiar, or with most names, of the Frankfurter Schule, Max Horkheimer, Theodor Adorno. They're also very well known because of their text Dialektik der Aufklärung, Walter Benjamin, Herbert Marcuse, Jürgen Habermas, and also Erich Fromm. He's also a very well known scholar of critical theory. What does critical theory mean? So it basically, you can distinguish it from traditional theory. And in the words, or in the definition of Max Horkheimer, a critical theory has to meet three criteria. First of all, it needs to be explainable. It has to explain what is wrong with the current social reality. So it has to give more understanding or insight into understanding the problems of current social reality. But it also has to be practical. So it must not stop with just critiquing, but it also has to give or identify actors to change reality. So how can we improve it? And it's also very normative. So you also have to give clear norms that might lead to social transformation. So basically, the goal is human emancipation. And once again, not only explain or understand, but also change society. Keywords, and we will also see this in the next section on Marcuse, decreasing domination, oppression, control, and increasing individuals' freedom and liberty. So it's a combination, concisely, of normative philosophy and empirically informed social sciences. So that's once again, important, the practical goals, because it's not about merely understanding, it's also about changing, transforming society. Herbert Marcuse, and I guess you all had to read the first chapter of One Dimensional Man for this lecture. So he's a well-known philosopher, scholar of the Frankfurter Schule. He was born in Germany, but he left Germany because of the Nazi regime, and he published One Dimensional Man in the United States. And in his book One Dimensional Man, but also in his other works, he's very much influenced by Karl Marx and Sigmund Freud. He critiques capitalism, historical materialism, but also, of course, very interestingly for this course, modern technology, because he says that we have come to live in a technological society, and we might think that we're free, but actually we're living under the conditions of social control. Also in his works, especially One Dimensional Man, you will also see his critiques on power, control, oppression, and one of his main objectives is to increase freedom, liberty. So all these notions, of course, they also belong to critical theory. So One Dimensional Man was published in the 60s, 1964. It's a critique of capitalism, but also of communism, because basically he critiques social repression in different forms, either ultra-left-wing or extreme right-wing. And this book is very interesting for this course, especially because he deals with this relationship between technology, society, and politics. You cannot distinguish them, they all belong together. And one of the first, well, the first pages of One Dimensional Man, he writes about our unfreedom. So it's the 1960s, it's a post-Second World War, and capitalism is rising, of course. It's people on a very individual level, people have more money to buy the goods, the commodities. And he writes that comfortable, smooth, reasonable, democratic unfreedom prevails in advanced industrial civilization, a token of technical progress. Indeed, what could be more rational than the suppression of individuality and the mechanization of socially necessary but painful performances? Again, mechanization means that humans are being replaced by machines, or human labor is being replaced by machines. So society is undergoing ever-increasing processes of mechanization. And that this technological order also involves a political and intellectual coordination, maybe a regrettable and yet promising development. Because under this technical rationale or technical rationality, society needs to produce ever more, and people turn into consumers this way. And overall, One Dimensional Man reads as a general critique on technological rationality, which could be defined as the control or hegemony of technology. So what do we mean with technological rationality? It means a form of thinking that is based on control and manageability or creatability that leads to uniformity and one-dimensionality. I'll give some examples soon. So a society that allows different dimension still allows, of course, different views, different perspectives, different criticisms. But one of Marcuse's criticisms is that society is becoming, it's one dimension. There is, everything's becoming part of this technical or technological rationality. I'll give some examples soon. First, some quotes. So he says that we're being manipulated, or needs are being manipulated. And he distinguishes between false and true needs. And of course, he's very, also in under influence of Marx, he's very critical for advertisements, for capitalism. Because he says that we're being seduced, by these advertisements. But actually, we don't need all these products. We are being seduced by them. We're also being told that whenever we buy a product, it will bring us happiness, or it will bring us a new identity. But these all belong to false needs. The needs which perpetuate toil, which means labor, tough labor, aggressiveness, misery, and injustice. Most of the prevailing needs to relax, to have fun, to behave and consume in accordance with the advertisements, to love and hate what others love and hate, belong to the category of false needs. So he says, or one of his criticisms is, we have this idea that we're free when we buy all these products, but actually the way we have to behave, the way we have to, for instance, dress, it's all being prescribed. We're not that free or autonomous as we might think. And he also, what he means with one-dimensionality is that we're all becoming like consumers. It's just like one identity. He also writes about which binds the consumers more or less pleasantly to the producers and through the latter to the whole. The products indoctrinate and manipulate. So basically, our goal as human beings in a Western capitalist society is to maximize productivity and entertainment. Entertainment as well, free time, leisure time, it's also being prescribed what we have to do, how we have to spend our free time. So basically, once again, we might think we're free, but actually we're following the logics of the market. We're following the logics of capitalism, of entertainment. And this way we're being controlled, and we're not as free as we might think we are. And one of his overall goals with one-dimensional man is to, once again, increase our freedom, to show that we're unfree under these conditions, and to show ways that lead to more freedom. That we as customers, as citizens, start to notice a difference between false and true needs. So he writes about this pattern of one-dimensional thought and behavior, in which ideas, aspirations, and objectives that by their content transcend the established universe of discourse and action are either repelled or reduced to terms of this universe. So they are redefined by the rationality of the given system and of its quantitative extension. One of his other critiques is that the qualitative is being suppressed. More and more attention is going to quantification, which actually, and might be interesting for the discussion afterwards, is also a very present day topic, because nowadays we have Internet of Things, we have social media, and our social and moral interactions have also become part of the network, of the internet. And hence, they have become part of a logic of data, algorithms, quantification. So, in 1964, he already writes about the other, so our moral relation with the other is appearing more and more as a calculable manifestation. He also criticizes processes of automation, mechanization, and they all lead, once again inspired by a Marxist framework, to alienation and to unfreedom. He also writes that our private space has been invaded and whittled down by this technological reality. Of course, in 1964 he was hinting at television and advertisements, but in a present-day framework, we could talk about the internet, smartphone, which of course is very pervasive in our private spaces as well. So what can we do about all this? Very shortly, Marcuse also writes about the great refusal. So we don't have to accept this kind of society. We can revolt against it. We have we also have a voice to say no, because he's also criticizing an overly positivistic society. Think about the quantification, and we have a voice to say no to this repression, to domination, and by saying no, we can strive for a transformation. But of course, first of all, we need to be aware of distinctions between what we really need, the true needs, and the false needs. We need to understand in which ways we're being seduced by these objects, by these advertisements. And only if we understand these forms of social control, we can really say no, and we can really start to transform society. Okay, that's all for Marcuse, because he had a tough reader for today's class. He also had to read Andrew Feinberg, and he studied under Marcuse. And this idea of critical theory, the Frankfurter Schule, he extrapolates this notion to technology. And actually, when you might have explained this already, when you look at philosophy of technology, there are basically two important periods. So I'm just going to write it down. From more or less 1920 to 1980, we talk about the classical philosophy of technology. And to this group belong, amongst others, Herbert Marcuse, Martin Heidegger, Jean Baudrillard, you might be familiar with him as well, Horkheimer, Adorno, they all belong to the classical philosophers of technology. And starting from the 1980s, we have contemporary philosophy of technology. And Feinberg belongs to the contemporary philosophy of technology, although, of course, he studied under Marcuse. Now, why is this distinction important? Because the classical philosophers of technology, they were very, in general, very negative about technology. Which may not surprise, because throughout this period in the 20th century, for the first time in history, people were confronted with the damaging or the detrimental effects of technology. For the first time in history, there are technologies that put the earth and human beings at risk. Think, for instance, about the atom bomb, the atomic bomb, about Hiroshima, Nagasaki in 1945. Also think about Auschwitz or Treblinka, where a technology was being used to extinguish man, which is also one of the topics of Dialektik der Aufklärung, the text by Horkheimer and Adorno. So they were very negative. Also, that was much later, of course, nuclear threats and Chernobyl. So it was, they were very negative, but of course there were examples that made it not so strange that they were very negative. But the contemporary philosophers of technology, they have criticized the old school, because the classical philosophers of technology, they mostly wrote about the technology. I've understood that you're familiar with Heidegger's philosophy of technology. You can really see it clearly coming to the fore there. He talks about the technology without distinguishing any particular examples. they were also very negative because they didn't talk about positive aspects of technology, and they didn't use more concrete examples. Andrew Feinberg, being a contemporary philosopher of technology, he works more about he works more on concrete examples of technology, and he also looks for interdisciplinary collaboration. So, for instance, he also consults more empirically informed studies. He also works with media studies, STS, and this way it's a more concrete, practical form of philosophy of technology. He doesn't write about the technology, he doesn't write in a one-sided way about technology as one monolithic block, but he's much more concrete. So although he studied under Marcuse, he really belongs to contemporary philosophy of technology. And one of the clear effects or consequences is that he seeks to combine this more or less old school theoretical philosophy of technology with more constructivist, more empirically informed, more practical technology studies. So he writes in his text that you all have in your reader that human beings can only act on a system to which they themselves belong, which is, this is already really important, because of course whenever you as a developer develop a technology that has a major impact, you yourself will also experience that impact. It's not like God, like a transcendental being who can create something and not experience the results. Are you familiar with Heidegger's text on Die Frage nach der Technik? Did you already discuss that?
Yes.
Is that a yes? Okay. So he also refers to Heidegger because, of course, as you should know, for Heidegger, the essence of technology is being explained by, an ontological phenomenology, because he uses the history of design, of being, to look at the essence of technology. Heidegger as well also refutes an instrumentalist view on technology, because it's never neutral. And very important with Heidegger is that we have come to see reality, so also being, as a standing reserve, as a resource for our own sakes. So for instance, trees, we cannot look at them anymore and just enjoy their sight. No, we also think about, okay, how can we cut those trees? What can we make of them? So it's just a resource for our power and control. He doesn't follow Heidegger there. He refers again to Marcuse, and he says, for Marcuse, but also for myself, technology is configured as a way to reproduce the rule of the few over the many, which of course also in a present-day framework, and think about the discussions we had last weeks about fake news and algorithms and the power of big companies such as Google, such as Facebook. So the notion of power, which of course links very clearly to Marcuse, to Frankfurter Schule, he writes about technological power as the principal form of power in society. And he seeks to open up technology and redesign it in such a way that it leads to a democratic transformation. Democratic in the sense that the many also get more power and not only the few. And what does he propose as a way of reaching this opening up, to move away from this power? He proposes a combination of essentialist philosophy of technology and a constructivist approach, which also links up perfectly with the key notions in critical theory, where also theory is being linked with empirical social research. And he writes that technology must always be analyzed at two different levels. First, level of our original functional relation to reality, so basically looking at the technical reality, first in a very decontextualized matter. More on that soon. And the second level is the level of design and implementation in a context, a societal context, a moral context, a cultural context, and so further. So, first level, we need to look at the affordances, the possibilities that there are in the object that can be mobilized in devices and systems by decontextualizing the objects of experience and reducing them to their useful properties. So it's a process of deworlding, decontextualizing, in which objects are torn out of their original contexts and exposed to analysis and manipulation. So this basically comes down to a critical, theoretical analysis on the technical level. For instance, take the example of robotics, that would mean that you're just going to look at the technology. How is the technology engineered? What is possible with the technology? But you're not looking at a broader context. On the second level, it's about recontextualization. So, and this is also why Feinberg obviously is a present day or a contemporary philosopher of technology, because he always takes into account the broader context, that technology is never merely an object, it's also it also belongs to a broader context, a moral context, a political context, a cultural context, and so further. And this is actually referring to the constructivist or empirical approach. So, for instance, again with the robotics, that you move away from the merely or the purely technological, but you also go to look at robotics in society. For instance, care robotics, how would you design them? And how will people react to care robots? And what would be ethical implications? For instance, if people have a care robot, will isolation, will feelings of loneliness and isolation increase because they're not talking to a human anymore, and so further. So you're actually going to look at a broader context. You're also going to take into account the bias of design, because once again, technology is never neutral. If you have a robot who will help you in the household, it would be very stereotypical to design your robot as a female, as a woman, for instance, because of course we still have this idea that in our society, household work is still related to women. So you could actually design your robot in a very feminine way, but then, of course, you're enforcing all the stereotypes. To end Feinberg, his idea of critical theory of technology, it offers a platform for reconciling many apparently conflicting strands of reflection on technology. So first, the decontextualizing part, and then afterward the reconceptualizing part. And only through an approach that is both critical and theoretical and empirically oriented, it is possible to make sense of what is going on around us now. So first, study the object itself in a technical way, and then on a second level, study the object in a broader context. So, theory. We might come back to it in the discussion. The second part of this lecture is on feminist theory and technology, because technology and design is never value-free, and it's also contains a lot of stereotypes, and in the first place about gender. You might be aware of all the fuss that there was a couple of years ago with Big for Her. Does anyone know? Has anyone heard of Big for Her before? You're not. Okay. So there was a lot of discussion and also a lot of humorous reaction on Big for Her, because it's a pen designed for women, which of course is extremely weird, because why would women need their own pen? And then there was a lot of humoristic response that we women needed our own pen to write grocery shopping lists, for instance. And of course, these pens are always pink and pastel, very feminine. But of course, this is not value-free. It says a lot about how society and also the male developers at BIC think about women. We need to design some special pen for women, because apparently their very soft hands cannot write with a male pen. Second example is the lady shave. And why did I include this example? Because it's always funny to see that the lady shave somehow needs to be pink. It always has to be pink, whereas shaving material for a man is not necessarily blue, but when it is for women, it's pink with glitter. So actually, you already see a lot of stereotypes about women in the design. Final picture is about Seat, the famous car brand that developed Seat Me. It's a car for women, because apparently, once again, we cannot just drive with a regular car. No, we need a purple car, co-designed with Cosmopolitan. It's a magazine for women. And I invite you to watch a very short advertisement on YouTube on Seat Me, because you can, it's on YouTube, and it's really interesting, because a woman of Seat meets the editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan, and they talk about this car for women, because apparently women, when they buy a product, one of the questions, how does it make me feel, does it make me feel sexy, is apparently very important, so they wanted to reflect this as well in a car. And we're very excited about designing the accessories, because a car for women, it needs extra place to put your handbag, etc. So this is all not neutral. It says something about society, or Western society deals with women. And you can directly see this reflected in the design. It's pink, it has to be fun, it's about being sexy, it's about how we look. So it's all very, very stereotypical ideas of women. And of course, it may not surprise that there is, within technology studies, there is this feminist strand that seeks to respond and react to all these designs. I've said it before, it's never neutral, but it's also not gender-free. Technology and technological objects are always filled with social, political, cultural, and moral dimensions. And there were two texts included in your reader, one by Wendy Faulkner and one by Judy Weichmann, and they both seek to move away from technological determinist views.
Sorry, when you say reader picture, because on Moodle I didn't find anything to read for this week. Is this just my Moodle?
Well, I don't know about this, but I have been told that you should read for today Marcuse.
Because normally we find it on Moodle, and at least I didn't find anything to read.
And it's all the rest. Did you find the text? None of you. Okay. What's the name of your research assistants? We have to send an email then, because that's what I was told.
Yeah, I think also last time it was put on after the lecture, actually,
yes.
Wasn't it? Yeah, I think that's probably.
Oh, really?
That is apparently best practice here that they put it on
no,
last
time.
Time
I read it before the lecture.
No.
Oh, it was before last time. Oh, okay. So
because
no.
I was
no
told
idea.
That you should have read all these texts by now, but apparently not. Okay. Yeah, you should have. You should say that earlier. Yeah, I don't know anything about this, but we'll tell the teaching assistants. So there's actually four texts. So Fieldwork, Critical Theory of Technology, it's an article. Then the first chapter of One Dimensional Man. One text on feminist theory, it's an article. And then this is a book, but it's a small book, about 130 pages. Written by Judy Weichman. She works at LSE in London, and it's on techno-feminism. Okay, but it's good that you tell me. I'll try to be less specific about the texts. So, first of all, Wendy Faulkner, her text on the technology question in feminism, it focuses on the relationship between feminist theory and technology. And in her text, she starts with a distinction between, on the one hand, women in technology, and on the other hand, women and technology. So basically, the women in technology comes down to a very simple question: why are there still so few women in engineering? That, for instance, when it comes to care and become a nurse, for instance, that's a very feminine job. But when you have to imagine an engineer in your head, chances are high that you see a man, because it's so stereotypical, the male engineers. And then on the second, or on the other hand, you have women and technology. And this focuses on specific technologies or technological arenas encountered by women. For instance, when it's technology about reproduction, of course, it focuses very much on women, for instance, anticonception pill, because women are also on the receiving end of technology, not so much on the engineering part, but on the receiving end. But Faulkner and also Weichman in her book, she criticizes the determinist views on women and technology. Either they're very optimistic, and I'll give the example of Donna Haraway later, that for instance with the internet, women will be freed because the internet makes possible a mind-body split, and their outer appearance is not noticeable online, so you will escape all the stereotypes of being addressed as a woman. Or either very pessimistic views that women are victims of men's technology, that women are passive, that they have no agency themselves, that they just have to undergo what male designers design for them. So she tries to come up with a more constructivist, but also more nuanced framework, exactly to analyze this relationship between technology and gender. And the guiding concern and the founding question of her article is on how is technology gendered. And she discusses different ways in which technology is gendered. First of all, she makes another distinction between gender in and gender of. when it's about gender in technology, it's literally gender relations being embodied in artifacts. And this is an example that Faulkner gives, but also Weichmann gives it in her book. It's about the microwave. Is everyone of you familiar with interpretative flexibility? Have you heard about interpretative flexibility before? No, okay. It's in the book of Weichmann, and I'll also explain it. So it's interpretative. Flexibility, and it belongs to Scott's social construction of technology, social shaping of technology. Now, what does interpretative flexibility mean? It means several things, but it's that an object, a technological object, is never fixed. So, for instance, you have to see technological design more as a process. So a developer designs a technology, but it's possible that the end users will either accept the technology as it was designed, or either refuse to use it, or use it in a different way. There are some very famous examples of interpretive flexibility, for instance, about the bike. You might know the famous Dutch philosopher of technology, Wiebe Beke. He wrote a book on interpretative flexibility. And one of his examples is on the bike, because the first bikes in the 19th century, for a present-day biker, look very uncomfortable with one big wheel, one small wheel. But he says, when this bike was designed like that, people didn't really look at it as uncomfortable, because only men were riding the bike, and it was like one big wheel, one small wheel, and men who were able to ride this bike, they somehow were very respected by women. So actually one of the first views on the bike was a bike as a sort of macho machine. So the man who could ride this bike, he could count in a lot of appraisal and awe by women.
I read that these kinds of bikes were forbidden because of too many fatalities. Because you were riding so high, and if you crashed, you would probably die.
Okay, but so you also had the dangerous aspects, but there was also another important reason why the design of bikes was eventually changed, namely when women also started to ride a bike. And only then the bike more started to have another connotation, namely the bike as a transport machine. So when you have two wheels at the same level, you can use the bike as a transport machine. So he writes about interpretative flexibility, by which he means that technology also has changing meaning. So first it was a macho machine, and then it was for transport. And so you always have to see technology and design in a context. And that's why I refer to interpretive flexibility, because the microwave example is also part of, is also a good example of interpretive flexibility. Because initially it was designed for single men, the men who don't want to cook for themselves, because cooking was a very feminine thing to do, and that just wanted to put a pizza in the microwave. So initially it was designed as a brown good, and there's brown goods versus white goods. Brown goods refer to consumer technologies such as television, radio, computer, and white goods, they refer to household appliances, very feminine household appliances. And you can literally see that in the color, because white goods, white household appliances for women are white, like a washing machine, an ironer generally is white. And with the microwave, so initially it was designed for single men, and it was literally put in the shops next to the hi-fi stereos, next to the radios, next to the televisions. But it was not successful amongst single men, but it became successful among housewives, because it was very useful in the kitchen to heat something up in a faster way. And so the microwave, it literally changed color, it became a white good, and it also literally and physically changed place in the shop. So it was not with the televisions and radios anymore, no, the microwave was with next to the washing machines.
Is the white also a symbol of cleanness,
purity?
Purity, which is which belongs to women.
Could be. I don't know.
As a stereotype.
Yeah, could be, because that's interesting. But also another example of gender in would be pink goods, because the examples that I previously gave about. For instance, the lady shave, that's also an example of gender in, because it's very clear immediately by color that it's intended for women. On the other hand, you have gender off, and that means that it's more by association. Not literally, not literally, but by association. And yeah, again, examples are like household appliances, we kind of intuitively relate them to women, whereas gardening tools, we relate them to men. So it's an association, a gender association that we make. Both Faulkner and Weichmann, they focus on the wider gender contexts. So the gender of the associations within which individual technologies are designed and used. She also, Faulkner, she also writes about masculine images, because she says when it comes to technology, it's still very often in a very male or masculine way. For instance, nerd, being a nerd, it only refers to men who spend too much time behind their computer. There is not really a word for female nerds. And she also criticizes the mismatch between the image that we still have of technology as masculine and the practice when it comes to gender, because of course nowadays a lot of women also have technical jobs, and just because you're a man, it doesn't mean that you're always technically competent. Another example is on gender symbols and technical knowledge and practice. And she gives this example to show that even within this image of masculinity, of males and technology, there are also different hierarchies. And she refers to this class-based dualism, that on the one hand you have the educated engineers, and on the other hand you have the workers, the physical workers, and the latter ones, they're working in a greasy workshop, and the skilled engineers are working in a clean office. So also within males or masculine gender, there's a lot of distinction. She also writes about gender identity in relation to technology, and she refers to a couple of studies that were being conducted among engineers, and apparently the data showed a lot of pleasure that engineering also related to control and domination, in the sense that I invent this technology and many people will use it, and I have so much control, and the decisions that I make will eventually have a lot of impact on society. So in her text, she also refers to, or she relates this to eroticism, this feeling of being in control. Although studies also show that as an engineer, you often also are powerless, because you only have this, your share is limited, of course. And she also refers to other studies on women engineers who apparently still find it very hard to belong to the club, by which they mean to belong to this male club, to become a true engineer, because apparently there are still a lot of gendered images within this whole field of engineering. So, technology is gendered in several ways. First of all, because a lot of specialists are still men. Also because technological artifacts can be gendered by design. Think about Big for Her or Lady Shave. But, and this is really important, the interpretative flexibility once again, which also shows that you as a user, you have an agency. You don't have to accept the technology the way it was designed. There are a lot of examples that show how technology eventually was used differently. For instance, the internet. It was designed in the 60s as ARPANET. For Homeland Security, Department of Defense in the US. It was only intended for government workers who were responsible for Homeland Security, but they soon started to use the technology, and the whole idea, of course, was that from a remote space you could enter centralized information. So that was the first idea of the internet. So you don't have to physically around the centralized information, you can access it from a distance. But even there, it immediately showed that although it was in the context of military and homeland security, employees started to use the technology in a social way. So they started to send social messages to each other. So the internet was never initially intended as a social medium, but because people started to use it in a social way, the design also made changes. For instance, with when the first smartphone, it was 2007, the first iPhone in 2007. After the success and wider dispersal of the smartphone, the selfie became popular. But so the design, and that's once again interpretative flexibility, so the design was redesigned. And nowadays you have smartphones with a camera, and that they have a button, and you just have to press the button, and the camera is turning, so you don't actually have to move. You can make a selfie in a more comfortable way. But of course, the first smartphones didn't have that turning camera perspectives, because the selfie didn't exist. Well, of course, there were self-portraits, but there was no selfie. The smartphone made the selfie popular, and then afterwards, the designers started to, improve the cameras, for instance, by adding this turning button. So actually, once again, technology is always this process. It's never fixed. And Faulkner also refers to interpretative flexibility exactly to show also when it comes to women, no, we're not passive, we have a voice, we have an agency, we don't have to accept all these designs. She also refers to the mismatch between the stereotypical IDs that we still have, but that might be very far away from practice. And she argues in favor of social shaping of technology. And she says that when it comes to feminism and from a broader perspective, gender relations in society, we cannot confront this challenge without engaging in technology. So when we want to change the situation for women in society, also Western societies, we have to take into account technology and the way it is gendered. And a similar aim we can find in Judy Wegman's Technofeminism, so it's this book. You can find it here in the library. And there is a lot of overlap between Faulkner and Wegman. Faulkner also refers to Wegman in her article. And technofeminism seeks to understand, once again, gender and technology, and also to this idea of co-shaping, mutual shaping of gender and technology. So the overall aim is to provide an opportunity to explore the complex ways in which women's everyday lives and technological change interrelate in the age of digitalization. And she seeks to offer a middle path between utopian optimism on the one hand and pessimistic fatalism on the other hand. And she also says that technofeminism is not purely theoretical, it's also political. Why political? Because, and there are many examples of this, revolutions in technology do not create new societies, but they do change the terms in which social, political, and economic relations are played out. Think, for instance, about the Arab Spring and the alleged role of social media there as a are the official governmental means of communication, and of course the less hierarchical social media that were being used in the uproar, in the riots. So although social media were not designed to change political reality, it can be used that way. Or of course the discussion of the last week's about the role of algorithms and in specific the roles of Google's and Facebook's algorithms in the presidential elections in the US, because of course research shows that 4 out of 10 Americans nowadays see Facebook or use Facebook as their primary news source. So they consult Facebook to look for news and to improve their knowledge about the world. Facebook is of course driven by algorithms, and the way these algorithms precisely work is a company secret, we don't really know. But they don't really distinguish between fake news and factual news. So there were many examples of how fake news stories were shared online, and it's really hard to debunk them. So for instance, on your Facebook wall, fake news can just intermingle with news coming from more trustable news sources such as The Guardian or The New York Times. There's not really a distinction being made. There's also a lot of interesting research on that. For instance, when someone publishes a fake news story and it goes viral, so it's being shared avidly worldwide. On average, it takes 13 hours to debunk the story. So that's one of the challenges in contemporary society is, of course, how are we going to deal with all these fake news stories, and how can we deal with them in a more or in a faster way? So there are many political dimensions in technology. One of the reasons why Weichmann wrote this book, but she also has a number of other books on techno-feminism, it's she says that we need feminist studies of technologies in order to avoid gender blindness. We have to improve or literally open people's eyes that technology is not gender neutral. But she also warns against the danger that we may not trap into the essentialist position, which sees technology as inherently patriarchal. So the doom story, the idea that women are only victims of male designers. She discusses many different views in her book, and I only have time to elaborate on one of them. She also has a chapter on cyber feminism, and especially also on Donna Haraway. You can see her Cyborg Manifesto. Who has never heard of the Cyborg Manifesto? Okay. We'll elaborate on that very soon. So what is cyberfeminism? It actually relates to feminism and the internet. Also feminism and cyborgs. And there's a lot of utopian views on cyberfeminism. I hinted at that before. Online, people cannot see that you're a woman, so you're immediately free from being treated in a very stereotypical way. So cyber technologies can help women to increase their power, to transcend their biological body, more on that soon, and also to redefine themselves. And a Cyborg Manifesto, it's a seminal text written by Donna Haraway in 1985. You can find the text online. It's a very well-known text. So it was published 31 years ago, and last year there was a lot of conferences specifically on that text, so it had a lot of impact. When you read it yourself, you might not be so enthusiastic about it because it's written in a very obscurantist style, so there's not really a core line of argumentation. It's also written in a very fluid way, but of course Donna Haraway, she says, yeah, but it's intended that way because I don't want to I don't want to fix my text. I just want to have attention for fluidity. So who is Donna Haraway? She's actually a biologist. She was born in 1944, and she also takes her identity as a professor in biology to play with gender. She says biology is stereotypical masculine field of study, but I, as a woman, I have a PhD in biology, so I already play with my identity and my femininity. And in 1985, she published the Manifesto for Cyborg Science, Technology, and Socialist Feminism in the 1980s. And the whole text is about the image of the cyborg that she sees as a way to deconstruct essentialist thinking about women in Western technologies and sciences and political culture. And she starts from the assumption that the morals, the modern scientific technological worldview is all about men dominating women, because man, human, it's male, is trying to dominate nature, and our image of nature is Mother Earth. What? It's not Father Earth, no, it's Mother Earth. So we already have this very feminine idea of planet Earth, and we seek to control our environment, we seek to control our planet, and she sees this as a metaphor for men controlling women. And throughout this text, she takes the cyborg as a metaphor and also as a political tool for women to overcome this nature ID. Nature also refers to the idea that women are the caregivers. So basically, women are already put in a very stereotypical position. First, they have to be dominated by men, and second, they have to give care, they have to give birth. So they already have this fixed identity. But she says, we have become cyborgs, and cyborg means partly computer, partly human. And we as women, we have to embrace our cyborg identity, because it's a way to free us from this fixed identity. Because a cyborg is fluid, a place with boundaries, and we as women, we all have to be, and we have become cyborgs, and this is a means to escape these pre-given ideas of women. And she tries to debunk dualisms in her essays. So she writes about troubling dualisms such as self versus other, mind versus body, male versus female, active versus passive. And high-tech culture challenges these in intriguing ways. It is not clear who makes and who is made in the relation between human and machine. And in her Cyborg Manifesto, she writes about three crucial boundary breakdowns. First of all, the boundary between man and animal has been deconstructed. In 1859, Charles Darwin published The Origin of Species, and since then, there is no clear-cut distinction anymore between men and animals, so the boundaries have become fluid. Another example is, of course, animal rights. We not only talk about human rights, but also about animal rights. Another boundary that has been debunked is between organism, and with organism she means both animals and humans, and machines. For instance, modern medicine. And I think a great example here would be Stephen Hawking. How much of him is man and how much of him is machine? It's hard to define. The machines keep him alive. So he actually, this boundary between man and machine, it's very fluid. You cannot really grasp it. But also the physical and the non-physical, which she looks upon as a subcategory of the boundary between organism and machine, it has also become very fluid. For instance, nanotechnology, literally dwarf technology, it's so small, you can have it under your skin without people noticing it. For instance, think about the pacemaker. You could say that we said that people that carry a pacemaker, and nowadays you also have pacemakers that are connected to the internet, so that people or patients with a pacemaker, they're already cyborgs, because they're partly machine and or computer and partly human. And so Haraway, she not only has a feminist goal with this text, but also a political goal. because she takes this image of the cyborg and cyberspace. Once again, cyborg is a way to liberate women of these patriarchal dualisms. To her, it's clear that we've already become cyborgs, fabricated hybrids of machine and organism. And through the cyborg, we have a new perspective on reality, namely hybridization. There is no fixed identity with a cyborg. And we, as women, we should embrace ICTs to reconceptualize our bodies, because they enforce new social relations for women worldwide. Also because of popular reproduction tools such as IVF. This image for women, that they're only here to reproduce, is already being debunked, because there's also in vitro fertilization, for instance. But of course, anno 2016, there are new evolutions in fertility. And she says, like, eventually, maybe we're not even needed there anymore. They don't need our womb anymore. So this is also a way to escape our predetermined role as mother. So, to conclude, one more slide. She also talks about a post-gender world. So she's very, very utopian about the cyborg. She says, because of the cyborg, we don't have this trouble with gender relations anymore. We have come to live in a post-gender world. Weichmann and others, of course, they criticize Haraway for this, because she's overly optimistic, and she also has a very essentialist, although she denies it, she still has a very essentialist view on women, exactly because she has such clear-cut solution. Her solution is very clear-cut. It doesn't seem to cross the complexity of gender. And Weichmann, and I think this is a very important definition that she gives, that also fits perfectly within social shaping of technology. Technology must be understood as part of the social fabric that holds society together, so never just as a technological object on itself. It's also a socio-material product. It follows that technological change is a contingent and heterogeneous process in which technology and society are mutually constituted or shaped. And when you read the texts of Faulkner and Weichmann, you will see, of course, that they both defend this constructivist perspective. Now, we still have some minutes left for some discussion points or some questions, and despite what I've been told, I know that you haven't read the texts. But maybe from what I've told, and I've talked a lot, there might be some interesting perspectives to share. For instance, maybe Wendy Faulkner, who writes that the challenge of the technology question in feminism means that we cannot transform gender relations without engaging in technology. What are your views on this? How could we improve or liberate women in Western society by looking or by engaging in technology?
Isn't there already engaged? I mean, we all use computers, notebooks. I have many friends who work in the IT, feminine friends. So I don't see a problem in Western societies compared, for example, to Eastern societies. Mm-hmm. So
And what would be, yeah, you can, I don't need to, we don't need to focus on Western society, so what would you suggest?
Well, for instance, for societies with the traditional model of, role model of woman and man, it's not only about gender, it's about policy, economics, finance. It's quite understandable. The women in those societies, they just don't have the opportunity to find a job. Therefore, they are economically always dependent, should be dependent to survive. So it's not only the question of technological involvement, but rather the whole spectrum of social, political, and economical country, state, and whatever. So.
But would you deny that in Western society we have these problems?
I wouldn't take them serious, I would say. If you don't like the pink raisins, just unbuy them. I mean, and that's what probably many women, men, if they didn't like black raisins, they also don't buy them. So, yeah, the marketing is always a manipulation towards men or women, children, elderly people as well. So, I mean.
Anyone else who wants to share thoughts on this? That when it comes to technology and feminism, there is, we particularly have to, for instance, think about Eastern societies?
No, I had a different point. So I'm still wondering how techno-feminism would deal with this idea of interpretative flexibility. For example, if you talk about the lady shave, that the example might have been valid like 5 or 10 years ago, but nowadays, actually, you do have blue and green. So
they're not so widespread as the pink ones.
I don't know, but you can easily find them. So, I mean, so to kind of, to take examples, for example, of something that is gendered, yes, it is gendered, but it's also interpretatively, like it's subject to interpretative flexibility. So then it can degender eventually. So how does one take into account such developments? So because on the one hand, if you say that everything is inherently gendered, but on the other hand, you also accept that something can degenerate, so to say, how does that relate to each other?
Well, I don't think that these authors, that they focus solely on the fact that everything is inherently gendered, is, I don't think that they have it in such a clear-cut way. It's just that they say that we have to be aware for the fact that that there are also gender perspectives playing, and we must not be blind for them. And I think that what they seek to do is just to move away from this idea that it's 100% gender, just to leave open room for interpretive flexibility and to make women, to make them more agentive, to give them more agency. But any other, or maybe some other question about?
I have another question regarding more Marcuse in here, and this notion of consumerism, and it's a question, more of an open question really, because now we know that this has become more or less common knowledge, that consumerism is bad, that our desires are being induced, and so on. And of course, that this has become common knowledge did not help us to overcome it in any way, which is also true. But there is, however, another way of seeing it also, I think. If you could like consumerism to Don Juanism of things, and in the way that Albert Camus sees it. So, this ever new and ever changing desire for new things, where the old ones are thrown away, and also the notion of quantity over quality gaining influence in our society. Albert Camus juxtaposes for this idea exactly Don Juan against the saint, where Don Juan has just quantity, but he loves every woman, just like the old one, and the saint only loves God. you know. So, but to him, Don Juan is not an unhappy man, you know. That's what I'm saying. Maybe consumerism, you could also see it that way.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that Marcuse is too negative?
Is too negative. Maybe it does just. Maybe it's good to see both sides. Mm-hmm. Just, of course, I see the dangers of this consumerism taking over. But maybe, I mean, we are not unhappy in the Western world where we live from consumerism. Mm-hmm. Of course, if you see it globally, it's devastating, the results, globally. Mm-hmm. Because we can live like that because the rest of the world goes to shit. Mm-hmm. That's also true. But
yeah, and because it's based on a model that these products are being created for a great part in sweatshops and
clothes. Right, exactly. So globally, of course. There's no question. There can be no question about it, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, of course, I didn't read Marcuse because mm-hmm. of the problem, but
yeah.
His critique is just of the Western society.
Yeah, but it's more like a very societal and activist question, but how would you, because of course these debates are very theoretical, but how would you imply that idea of Camus and Don Juan for the broader audience? So how can they address this idea and how, well, to relate? Because you criticize consumerism, but you also say...
I just think there's two ways of seeing it. Mm-hmm. Because we do, for example, if we take the iPhone,
mm-hmm.
Many people love the design and so on, and we love every new iPhone. Like, you know, we really want it, we desire it. It makes us happy.
Mm-hmm. Or we think it will.
Yeah, well, I think some people will be happy with it. So, just regarding this, what's the problem?
Mm-hmm.
It makes people happy. And, so.
Yeah, but then again, of course, we also know that iPhones are being created.
Right, just that's another topic, yes. But.
Of course, well, time's up. Is there any other question or urgent?
Question about the concept of the cyborg. Is it taken to be gender neutral from the beginning? Because when I think about cyborgs, and my images of cyborgs stem from computer games and movies. There are feminine and masculine cyborgs as well.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. Donna Haraway's view of cyborg is not informed by popular culture. She just takes the notion, by definition, partly human, partly computer, without specifying gender. And her aim is to use it as a political tool. So she doesn't talk about female or male cyborgs exactly because it's so fluid. But I truly agree with you that in popular culture, cyborgs are gendered. Any other?
I think I should very shortly explain what maybe because it's what Camus means.
Mm-hmm.
What is the general misconception of the Don Juan myth? Because the general misconception is that Don Juan is searching for and seeking for something that he never finds. But Camus says no, he finds it every time, and he finds it over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then this conception of consumerism as we actually have deeper desires and we try to fill it with these things, maybe this is false, maybe these are our desires.
But
and we find them all the time and make happy over again. It's not that we have some deeper desires, we don't have it.
But then it's just promoting hedonism, live in the moment, be happy in the moment.
Yeah, it's not that easy, I think, with Camus. Yes, I mean...
No, I
maybe
know. I'm more familiar with the... other words like coming, but any other questions?
Or just a comment, because maybe the woman or another person is an analogous to a new icon or a new object. In the
yeah, but there would be always flaws in these kinds of juxtaposition of theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's always a theory practical problem. Thank you for listening. I will tell the teaching assistants to put on these texts online. And yeah, maybe see you next time. Thank you.